card every morning and night and as many times during the day as you conveniently can. By so doing, you'll insinuate your goal into your subconscious mind. You'll see yourself as having already attained your goal and do that every day without fail, and it will become a habit before you realize it. A habit that will take you from one success to another all the years of your life. For that is the secret of success, the door to everything you will ever have or be. You are now, and you most certainly will become, what you think about. All creatures at birth are supplied with everything they need for successful survival. All creatures except one are supplied with a set of instincts that will do the job for them, and because of that, they don't need much of a brain. Take the magnificent bald eagle, for example. My wife and I saw dozens of them on a recent fishing trip in Alaska. To see one of them come swooping down and pluck a live and sizable fish from the water on a single pass is astonishing. More astonishing still is the eagle's eyesight, and because of its need to see small rodents moving in the grass from high altitudes or a fish just inches under the surface of the water, its incredible eyes take up just about all of the space in its head. For the eagle, its eyes are the most important thing, and everything else works in unison with them. Its brain is tiny and rudimentary. It doesn't think or plan or remember. It simply acts in accordance with stimuli. And it's the same with most other living creatures. Even the beautiful porpoise with a much larger brain and the chimpanzee are easily tamed and taught. Only one takes 20 years to mature and has dominion over all the rest and the earth itself, and has today the power to destroy all life on earth in a couple of hours. Only one is given the godlike power to fashion its own life according to the images it holds in its remarkable mind. Everything fashioned by human beings is a result of goal setting. We reach our goals. That's how we know that the diseases that plague us will be conquered. We've set goals to eradicate every disease that plagues us, and eradicate them we will, one by one. We have never set a goal that we have not reached, even landing on the moon, or are now in the process of reaching. No one ever made a purposeful accomplishment without a clear goal toward which to work. I hope you've established yours and that you've begun to think about it frequently every day to impress it into your mind, particularly your remarkable subconscious, where forces greater than we can imagine can come to your aid. For a moment, consider the things your mind has brought you. Everything you have, your work, your relationship with your family and others, your philosophy of life, all come to you as a result of using your mind, your religion. Now consider the estimate made by experts. You have probably been operating on less than 10% of your mental capacity, and probably much less than that. In an article for the Saturday Review, our old friend Herbert Otto, psychologist, educator, and chairman of the National Center for the Exploration of Human Potential, reminded us that many well-known scientists, such as the late Abraham Maslow, Margaret Mead, Gardner Murphy, O. Spurgeon English, and Carl Rogers, subscribed to the hypothesis that man is using a very small fraction of his capacities. Margaret Mead quotes a 6% figure. Herbert Otto writes, "My own estimate is 5% or less." Neurological research has shed new light on man's potential. Work at the UCLA Brain Research Institute points to enormous abilities latent in everyone by suggesting an incredible hypothesis. They said the ultimate creative capacity of the human brain may be, for all practical purposes, infinite. To use the computer analogy, man is a vast storehouse of data, but we have not learned how to program ourselves to utilize these data for problem-solving purposes. The following appeared in Soviet Life Today, a USSR English-language magazine. It said the latest findings in anthropology, psychology, logic, and physiology show that the potential of the human mind is very great indeed. As soon as modern science gave us some understanding of the structure and work of the human brain, we were struck with its enormous reserve capacity, writes Yefremov, eminent Soviet scholar and writer. He continues, "Man, under average conditions of work and life, uses only a small part of his thinking equipment. If we were able to force our brain to work at only half its capacity, we could, without any difficulty whatever, learn 40 languages, memorize the large Soviet encyclopedia from cover to cover, and complete the required courses of dozens of colleges." End of quote. That statement is hardly an exaggeration. It's the generally accepted theoretical view of man's mental potentials. Now, how can we tap this gigantic potential? It's a big and very complex problem with many ramifications. But as Herbert Otto points out, it's clear that persons who live close to their capacity, who continue to activate their potential, have a pronounced sense of well-being and considerable energy. They see themselves as leading purposeful and creative lives. The way most people use their minds can be compared to the time back in the early 19th century when just the eastern coast of the North American continent was settled, just a strip along the east coast. To the west stretched the raw, undeveloped great bulk of what was later to become the incredibly rich 90% of the economy. 90%, which resulted in the standard of living enjoyed today by Americans. If everything you have is the result of using just 5% of your mind, consider for a moment what it will mean to you and your family if you can increase this percentage. This cassette will show you how to use infinitely more of your mental powers, how to develop some of that more than 90% virgin territory. None of us, as a rule, has the slightest notion of the real capabilities of his or her mind, but believe me when I say that your mind can be compared to an undiscovered gold mine, and it makes no difference whether you're 17 or 70. Look at it this way. Your goal is in the future. Your problem is to bridge the gap which exists between where you now are and the goal you intend to reach. This is the problem to solve. Robert Seashore, then chairman of the Department of Psychology at Northwestern University, pointed out that successful people are not people without problems. They're simply people who've learned to solve their problems. And there you have it. Living successfully, getting the things we want from life, is a matter of solving the problems which stand between where we now are and the point we wish to reach. No one is without problems. They're part of living. But let me show you how much time we waste in worrying about the wrong problems. Here's a reliable estimate of the things people worry about. Things that never happen, 40%. Things over and past that can never be changed by all the worry in the world, 30%. Needless worries about our health, 12%. Petty miscellaneous worries, 10%. Real, legitimate worries, 8%. In short, 92% of the average person's worries take up valuable time, cause painful stress, even mental anguish, and are absolutely unnecessary. And of the real, legitimate worries, there are two kinds. There are the problems we can solve, and there are the problems beyond our ability to personally solve. But most of our real problems usually fall into the first group, the ones we can solve if we learn how. There must be millions of people today who feel they're being barred from the life they want because they look upon problems not as challenges to be met, but as wide chasms beyond their ability to bridge. A little research proves that successful people have the same kinds of problems. One of the very real benefits of working with a psychologist or psychiatrist comes from learning that there are hundreds of thousands, even millions of other people, with problems identical to our own. So the whole thing boils down to a matter not of problems which are common to us all, but to our ability to solve them. Now I'm going to assume you've decided on a goal. Remember, you will become, and you will achieve what you think about. That is, if you stay with it, you'll reach your goal. But how? It's right here that your mind comes into play. What is your mind, really? Nobody knows for sure. Perhaps the best way to describe it is to quote Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Archibald MacLeish. In his play, The Secret of Freedom, a character says, "The only thing about a man that is a man is his mind. Everything else you can find in a pig or a horse." That's uncomfortably true. The human mind is the one thing that separates us from the rest of the creatures on Earth. Everything that means anything to us comes to us through our minds, our love of our families, our beliefs, all of our talents, knowledge, abilities. Everything is reflected through our minds. Anything that comes to us in the future will almost certainly come to us as a result of the extent to which we use our minds. And yet it's the last place on Earth the average person will turn to for help. Do you know why? Do you know why people don't automatically turn their own vast mental resources on when faced with a problem? It's because they never learned to think. Now that is a fact, believe it or not. Most people never think at all during the entire course of their lives. They remember, but that's not thinking creatively or in new directions. They react to stimuli, but again, that's not thinking. Remembering to set the alarm at night and getting up when it rings in the morning does not take thought. Nor does showering, shaving, getting dressed, eating breakfast, going to work. At work, we once again fall into comfortable routines. At quitting time, we go home and start repeating the process. Most people, let me say it again, do not know how to think. When they're faced with a problem, they will go to any length to avoid thinking. They will ask advice from the most illogical people, usually people who don't know any more than they do, next-door neighbors, members of their families. Very few of them have reference books. But much more important than that, only one in I don't know how many thousands will take a large notepad, write the problem at the top of the page, and then deliberately turn on his or her thinking apparatus. But some people do think. They do indeed. In order to reflect a moment on the human mind, consider what it's accomplished. As you do, realize that we are developing so rapidly that we've come further in the realm of progress in the past 50 years than in all the preceding 10,000 years of human civilization. Of all the scientists who ever lived, it's estimated that 90% of them are alive today. We've reached in the area of ideas and human advancement a plateau so high it was undreamed of by even the most optimistic forecasters as recently as 30 years ago. But every new idea triggers additional ideas, so that now we're in an era of compounding advancement on every front and in every area that stagger the imagination. The harnessing of the power of the sun in our atomic plants and ships, the speed of light computers, which in minutes save months and years of calculating drudgery, every man-made thing you see and touch spawned from the most powerful agency in the world, the human mind. Dr. Harlow Shapley of Harvard has said that we're now entering an entirely new age of man. He calls it the psychozoic age, the age of the mind. And you, my friend, own one, free and clear. Now let's look at a few facts. The 40-hour week, long standard, is in imminent likelihood of being even further shortened. This means that the average working person has, at his disposal, an enormous amount of free time. In fact, if you total the hours in a year and subtract the sleeping hours, if he or she sleeps 8 hours every night, you'll find that this person has about 6,000 waking hours, of which less than 2,000 are spent on the job. Now, this leaves 4,000 hours a year when a person is either working or sleeping. These can be called discretionary hours, with which that person can do pretty much as he or she pleases. So that you can see the amazing results in your own life, I want to recommend that you take just 1 hour a day, 5 days a week, and devote this hour to exercising your mind. You don't even have to do it on weekends. Pick 1 hour a day on which you can fairly regularly count. The best time for me is an hour before the others are up in the morning. The mind's clear, the house is quiet, and if you like, with a fresh cup of coffee, this is the time to start the mind going. And here's one good way to do it. During this hour every day, take a completely blank sheet of paper. At the top of the page, write your present primary goal, clearly, simply. Then, since our future depends upon the way in which we handle our work, write down as many ideas as you can for improving that which you now do. Try to think of 20 possible ways in which the activity that fills your day can be improved. You won't always get 20, but even one idea is good. Now remember two important points with regard to this. One, this is not particularly easy. And two, most of your ideas won't be any good. When I say it's not easy, I mean it's like starting any other habit. At first, you'll find your mind a little reluctant to be hauled up out of that old familiar bed. But as you think about your work and ways in which it might be improved, write down every idea that pops into your head, no matter how absurd it might seem. Let me tell you what'll happen. Some of your ideas will be good and worth testing. The most important thing, however, that this extra hour accomplishes is that it deeply embeds your goal into your subconscious mind, starts the whole vital machinery working the first thing every morning, and 20 ideas a day, if you can come up with that many, total 100 a week, even skipping weekends. An hour a day, 5 days a week, totals 260 hours a year and still leaves you 3,740 hours of free leisure time. Now, this means you'll be thinking about your goal and ways of improving your performance, increasing your service. 6.5 full extra working weeks a year. 6.5 40-hour weeks devoted to thinking and planning. Can you see how easy it is to rise above that so-called competition? And it'll still leave you with 7 hours a day to spend as you please. Starting each day thinking, you'll find that your mind will continue to work all day long, and you'll find that at odd moments when you least expect it, really great ideas will begin to bubble up from your subconscious. When they do, write them down as soon as you can. Just one great idea can completely revolutionize your work and, as a result, your life. If you want to develop the muscles of your body, you take daily exercise of some sort. The mind is developed in the same way, except that the returns are out of all conceivable proportion to the time and energy spent. The mind of man can lift anything. His muscles, even the best developed, are puny alongside those of some of the dumbest animals on earth. If man had depended on his muscles for survival, he probably would have disappeared, as did the dinosaurs, which were incidentally the most physically powerful and most successful creatures that ever lived. Let me give you just some of the results people have reported to me as a consequence of following this one-hour-a-day routine. An office equipment salesman sold more of his company's product in 1 month than he informally sold in an entire year during the 4 years he'd been with his company. A Sunday school teacher with 5 pupils set a goal of 30 pupils. Her last letter told me she now has a class of 25. She's almost reached her goal. I've used this system for years, and it's given me some of the most gratifying and rewarding experiences of my life. And it costs only 5 hours a week, 5 hours out of 168. Is it worth it? It's like spending 5 hours a week digging in a solid vein of pure gold, because your mind is all of that and much more. Each time you write your goal at the top of the sheet of paper, don't worry or become concerned about it. Think of it as only waiting to be reached, a problem only waiting to be solved. Face it with faith and bend all the great powers of your mind toward solving it. And believe me, solve it you will. You know, this puts each of us in the driver's seat. Now let's briefly recap. 1. This week, start spending 1 hour a day getting as many ideas as you can. Try for 20 a day on ways to improve what you're now doing. Don't become discouraged. Remember, the achievement of your goal very likely depends upon it, as does your whole future. Once you start exercising your mind in this way, I know you'll want to continue the practice. 2. If everything you now have is the result of using, say, 5 to 10% of your mental ability, you can imagine what life will be like if you can increase this figure to 20% or more. 3. Successful people are not people without problems. They're simply people who've learned to solve their problems. 4. Don't waste time and energy worrying about needless things. 40% of them will never happen. 30% have already happened and can't be changed. 12% are needless worries about our health. 10% are petty, miscellaneous worries, and only 8% are genuine. Try to separate the real from the unnecessary and solve those which are within your ability to solve. 5. The human race has advanced farther during the past 50 years than in all the preceding 10,000 years of human civilization. We're now living right in the middle of the golden age man has been dreaming of and praying for centuries, and it's going to get better. Last of all, the only thing in the world that can take you to your goals in life is your mind, its effective use, and following through on the good ideas it supplies you. Each of us has a tendency to underestimate his or her own abilities. We should realize that we have, deep within ourselves, deep reservoirs of great ability, even genius, that can be tapped if we'll just dig deep enough. It's the miracle of your mind. I'm sure you find it as amazing as do the rest of us that the great majority of people have to learn things the hard way. It's only natural to think that if a great discovery were made in a particular generation, all the succeeding generations would know about it and utilize it for their own good. But in many things, such is not the case. It's true with most inventions and discoveries which obviously affect our lives, but it frequently is not true when it comes to the great laws which determine the directions of our individual destinies. In one of the so-called third world countries, a group of laborers was hired to work on a farm. Now, these people came from a small, very remote village where motor vehicles were virtually unknown. They were enjoying the new experience of being transported on the back of a truck when they came to the place where they thought they were supposed to get off. Without giving it a thought, apparently, they just stepped off the back of the speeding truck. Fortunately, they fell on a soft dirt road, not a paved highway, but even so, the results of their unconventional method of disembarking were, to say the least, astonishing. At least to them, they went bounding, spinning, sliding, and cartwheeling along the dusty road for quite a distance before gravity and friction working together finally brought them to a halt. None was seriously injured. In fact, by the time the terrified driver got back to them, they were laughing uproariously about the whole thing. The truck driver, in explaining the incident, later put the blame on their never having ridden in trucks before. Now, that's the obvious answer, but it's really not the true one. The amazing circus tumbling act on a remote farm road had been caused by ignorance of a law that operates the same whether a truck, a boat, an airplane, or any moving body is involved. Sir Isaac Newton gave us the law, and it goes like this. A body in motion tends to remain in motion until acted upon by an outside force. When the workers stepped off the back of the speeding truck, they were going the same speed as the truck itself. The outside force was gravity, which pulled them down to the road, still traveling, at the same speed, and, well, you get the idea. They had been hurt, confused, frightened, and turned upside down because they didn't understand the principal law on which everything in the universe operates, the laws of cause and effect. This law has been written thousands of times by the greatest minds the world has produced, and as a result has appeared in many forms. For our purposes, it might best be put this way. Our rewards in life will always match our service. It's another way of saying, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. And it's been written in many ways in every language on earth. Sir Isaac Newton, in promulgating his laws of physics, put this one in this way. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. In saying our rewards in life will always match our service, you'll almost always get general agreement. People will nod their heads and say, yes, that's certainly true. Then they will go their ways and never realize, for the most part, how close they came to a truth so great and all-enveloping that their every thought and action is affected by it. I like to think of this law in the form of a giant apothecary scale, the kind with a cross arm from which hang two bowls on chains. Now, one of the bowls is marked rewards, the other is marked service. Whatever we put into the bowl marked service, the world will match in the bowl marked rewards. How we think, work, talk, and conduct ourselves is what we have to put in the bowl marked service, and the extent and nature of our service will determine our rewards. If any person alive is discontented with his rewards, he needs to examine his service. Action, reaction. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. What you put out will determine what you must get back in return. So simple, so basic, so true, and so misunderstood. If a business is not expanding to the quick and exciting tempo of the times, it must examine its contribution, its service. If a person is unhappy with his income, he must examine and re-evaluate his service. Now, whom do we serve? Each of us serves a portion of humanity, and humanity, to any given person, is the people with whom he or she comes in contact. It's family, friends, neighbors, co-workers, customers, prospects, employer, all those he or she has chosen to serve. Everyone with whom we have any kind of contact is to us humanity, and to the extent that we serve, will our rewards be determined. Never before in the history of the world have human beings been so interdependent. It's as impossible to live without serving others as it would be to live if others were not constantly serving us, and this is good. The more closely knit this interdependence becomes, the greater will be human achievement. We need each other, and we literally cannot live without one another. Every time we strike a match, drink a glass of water, turn on the lights, pick up the phone, drive our car, put on our clothes, take a bath, mow the lawn, go fishing, try making your own fish hook sometime, we're being served by other human beings. Every time you look at your watch, you're being served by a great industry and by efforts of thousands of human beings. We all seek rewards, and we should understand that rewards come in two forms. There are tangible rewards and intangible, that is, rewards include the money we earn, the home we buy, the car we drive, the clothes we wear. But it also includes our happiness, our peace of mind, our inner satisfaction, the people we meet and enjoy. But remember this, whatever it is you seek in the form of rewards, you must first earn in the form of service to others. All attempts to sidestep this law will end in failure, frustration, and if maintained long enough, ultimate demoralization. We can see this frustration on every side. We can see it in the tense, strained and nervous faces, in the mountains of tranquilizers which are consumed every day, and we can also see it in the slack, bovine-like faces of those who have found the whole game too complicated and have simply given up, surrendered to the push and pull of circumstances. How much of this do you suppose is due to misunderstanding or ignorance of the simple and wonderful law of nature? It's my belief that a great deal can be traced to this cause. Now, do you understand this law, fully understand it, intellectually and emotionally? If you do, you can chart a wonderful course through life. Just as the field worker stepped off a speeding truck, just as a child will put its fingers in the way of a closing door, just as a speeding driver discovers he's not going to make the curve, how many times have you been confounded because you acted contrary to the rules? Not just the rules of man, but the rules of nature. How many times have you been in the position of the man who sat in front of the empty fireplace and said, "Give me heat, and then I'll give you some wood"? People seem to be divided into those who understand that the wood must be put in before they can expect warmth, and those who feel they should get warmth whether they do anything about it or not, or who feel they should get maximum heat from too small a supply of wood. A person's discontent can be said to be represented by the distance between what he or she has and what he or she wants. Once that which is wanted has been achieved, the odds are good that still more will be wanted, because that's the way of people, and that's good. That's a healthy sign. Constructive discontent is what gives us our continuing upward spiral of civilization. So do this, if you haven't already. Let's assume you've determined what it is you want. Look objectively at the place in which you now find yourself. Consider the distance separating you from your goal, and determine ways of increasing your service so you'll build a bridge across it. This puts thinking and creative activity into living. It also assures us that our goals can be achieved by individual effort and in the shortest possible time. One morning I was having breakfast in a restaurant in Monterey, California, one of the most naturally beautiful places in the world. Suddenly I was aware of the young people sitting in the booth next to mine. It was obvious that they were very unhappy, and the young man, they couldn't have been over 25, was saying, "Well, I've tried everywhere, but no one wants to give me a job. I guess we'll have to go back home." It was apparent from their attitudes that they wanted to live on the Monterey Peninsula, but were about out of money and unable to find a job. But he had said, "Nobody wants to give me a job." He wanted someone to give him something, in this case a job. What might have happened if he had turned the whole idea around? What if he had said instead, "What do I know how to do that will serve some of the people of this beautiful part of the world? Or how can I or we be of value to this community? The people here will be happy to supply us with the living we need if we can think of some way to serve them." If we can think of some way to serve them. What do they need or want that we can supply? Do they need a handyman, a first-class housekeeper, or both? Can we wash and wax cars right in their driveways, detail them so that they look like showroom display models? Let's buy a pad of paper and a ballpoint pen and start thinking of all the things we can do to earn a living here. It'll give us time to think of other ways, more profitable ways. But that wash and wax idea might grow into quite a service for the community. But let's don't stop there. Let's think of some more ways we can start right here to be of service to the people who live here. Right there in the restaurant, instead of being depressed and considering themselves failures, they could have come up with a dozen or so ways in which they could have remained on the Monterey Peninsula and built a fine business for themselves. They didn't need a job. They needed to think, but they had never thought before. It was as foreign to them as speaking Urdu. There they were, two fine, bright, good-looking young people, with a world of opportunity beckoning to them, with two fine minds, and they were going to go back home. No one had ever told them about the gold mines they carried between their ears. Do you know how many people would have reacted the same way these young people had reacted? They are most of the people in the United States, or any other country for that matter. People will do everything in the world, even turn to crime, before they will think. George Bernard Shaw once commented, "I've become rich and famous by thinking a couple of times a week. Most people never think at all." The young couple in Monterey, conscientious as they were not sowing, therefore they could not reap. They were putting nothing into the community, therefore they could expect nothing in return. To some this seems unfair, but it isn't. It's eminently and wonderfully and abundantly fair. Our job is to do the sowing. That's our department, that's all. The rest will take care of itself. We've been given the equipment free and clear. All we are asked to do is use it. Unfortunately, thinking is not taught in the public schools, or most of the private schools for that matter. Thinking is a subject, incredible as it may seem, that is totally ignored. A person's world can be compared to a plot of ground. It exists, it's there, it has inherent within itself an astonishing potential, and is prepared to react to a person's every action. In fact, it must. Whatever your job happens to be, think of it for a moment as this plot of ground. In the beginning, there's nothing there but earth. If a person sits and watches it, nothing will happen to it. If a few seeds are tossed on it, the rain and the soil's natural fertility will combine to reward that person with a few results for limited efforts. Action, reaction. It all depends on just what's wanted from this plot of earth. It's what is wanted that must first be decided. Let's say what's wanted is a beautiful lawn bordered by flower gardens with a big tree in the shade of which he or she can sit one day and admire the work. So the areas for the garden are marked off. The soil is cultivated, smoothed and cleaned of stones and trash. The lawn and flowers and the tree are planted. And from this point on, anyone observing this plot of land can evaluate in a second the amount of service, the contribution, this person is giving to the project. How can you tell? You can tell by seeing what the land is giving back to the person. Planting the plot is only the first step. We're given the plot. That's all we should be given. It's what we do with it that will determine its degree of greatness and success. It's like the story of the preacher who was driving by a beautiful farm. The fields were beautifully cultivated and abundant with well-cared-for crops. The fences, house, and barn were clean, neat, freshly painted. A row of fine trees led from the road to the house, where there were shaded lawns and flower beds. It was a beautiful sight to behold. So when the farmer, working in the field, got to the end of a row near the road, the preacher had stopped his car and hailed him, and he said, "God has blessed you with a beautiful farm." And the farmer stopped and thought a moment, and he replied, "Yes, sir, he has, and I'm grateful. But you should have seen this place when he had it all to himself." You see, the farmer understood that he had been blessed with a fine farm. but he was also aware that it was his own love and labor which had brought it to its present state. Each of us is given a plot to work, a lifetime, and the work we've chosen. Like the farmer, we'll be grateful if we have the vision, imagination, and intelligence to build well and successfully upon the seemingly unimpressive land of our beginnings. Or we can let it fall into a haphazard condition with no real continuity or purpose behind it, with unpainted, ramshackle buildings surrounded by weeds and debris. It's the same land. It's what we do with it that makes the difference. The miracle is there, if only we're wise enough to see it and to realize that our fulfillment as persons depends upon our reaction to what we've been given. In thinking of ways of increasing your service, read books on your specialty. Read what others have found to work well for them. Listen to these tape cassette programs of ours. But at the same time, think of original and creative ways of increasing your service, ways that are unique with you and the way you are. Going at it strong for a week or a month and then falling back into old habits is just like working for a week or a month on that plot of ground and then abandoning it. Before long, it'll be no better than before. Each morning, and during the day, ask yourself this question. How can I increase my service today, knowing that my rewards in life must be in exact proportion to my service? Now do this every day, and you'll have started to form one of life's most valuable habits. Horace Mann wrote, "If any man seeks for greatness, let him forget greatness and ask for truth, and he'll find both." You see, you can cut away all the confusion and complications and nagging worries and vague, half-formed fears by returning to the great truths, the great laws, the great verities on which all success, all accomplishment, in which the whole world is built. Drive down any street in the country, any street in any neighborhood or farm community, any street at all, and you can quickly see what the people on that street are doing for the good of the community by observing what the community is doing for them. Have you ever looked at it that way? We can tell by looking at a place of business what it's doing for the community by observing what the community has done for the place of business. Is it thriving and growing, or is it just holding its own, or soon to go out of business? Whatever the situation, it's a reflection of its service, how well its service, whatever it may be, is being accepted by the people. Is it meeting their needs and wants? It's the same with families and their places of residence. That's why I said you could drive down any street. Some streets are lined with beautiful, expensive homes, while some neighborhoods are obviously suffering from poverty, ramshackle, with weeds growing in the yards, tin cans and rubble strewn everywhere, rusted cars. It's a reflection of what the people living in those homes, beautiful and expensive, or run down and filthy, are doing for them and for the community. That's it. It's always been a matter of interest to me that in neighborhoods with high unemployment, the people there don't seem to have enough time to keep their homes and yards tidy. While those working the hardest, while those doing the most, have the cleanest, most attractive homes with well-manicured lawns and flower gardens. Environment is a mirror of the people in that neighborhood. Change the people, and the environment will change accordingly. It reminds me of the old saying, "What you are, speak so loudly, I can't hear what you're saying." One day a man was watching a professional football game on television. His 5-year-old son kept bothering him, so he took a page of the Sunday paper with a full-page airline ad on it showing a picture of the world, the planet Earth as seen from space. He tore the page up into a dozen pieces and gave them to his son. He said, "Here, put this together with this cellophane tape and show Daddy how smart you are." Then he went back to watching his football game. Well, in a surprisingly short time, the youngster had the picture all taped back together. It wasn't very neat, but it was a very good job indeed for one so young. "Hey, that's amazing," the father said. "How did you put that world together so quickly?" And the little boy said, "There was a picture of a man on the other side. I just put the man together, and then the world was all together." The youngster was no doubt surprised by the big warm hug he got. "That's right, son," the father said. "When the man's all together, his world is altogether too." Being together is understanding how things work. Working hard won't do it. That isn't enough. We have to work intelligently, How often have we heard someone say, my father worked hard all his life but never had anything to show for it? It's another way of saying, my father, may he rest in peace, never quite figured out how things work. He worked hard all his life, but it was a job with very limited service. Or in another case, it goes like this. My father was a very bright person, but he kept jumping from one thing to another. He was always looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but he never stayed with one thing long enough to work it out. Succeeding takes time. It takes dedication, 100% commitment, and creative thought. We must keep asking ourselves, how can I broaden my service, and by so doing, increase my harvest, my rewards? All right, how can we correct the situation? William James gave us the answer. He wrote, either some unusual stimulus fills them with emotional excitement, or some unusual idea of necessity induces them to make an extra effort of will. Excitements, ideas, and efforts, in a word, are what carry us over the dam. All right. Let your goal represent the excitement. Your ideas and efforts will weigh down the service end of the scale, and the rewards must and will follow. They'll be yours. They are yours the moment you realize the truth. As ye sow, so shall ye reap all the years of your life. If you're worried about your income or your future, you're concentrating on the wrong end of the scale. Look at the other end. Concern yourself only with increasing your service, with becoming great where you are, and your income and your future will take care of themselves. Don't be the person sitting in front of that empty fireplace and asking for heat. You're asking for the impossible. Pile in the wood first, and the heat will come as a result. Next time you're off by yourself in a quiet place, contemplate your plot of ground, your life, and begin to sow the seeds which will yield you a rich and abundant harvest. In William James' essay on vital reserves, he wrote, compared with what we ought to be, we're only half awake. Our fires are damped, our drafts are checked. We're making use of only a small part of our possible mental and physical resources. Stating the thing broadly, he went on to write, the human individual thus lives usually far within his limits. He possesses powers of various sorts which he habitually fails to use. He energizes below his maximum, and he behaves below his optimum. It is our intention that each of these messages be built upon a major principle, one of the great ideas which automatically produces the results we seek. In this message, let's talk about a principle that never fails. Following this particular idea gives quality and richness to life. It will also produce a peace of mind that never wavers, and the principle is integrity. Like other great ideas, it gets a lot of lip service, but it's seldom a true way of life. How people love and value a person of integrity. Integrity in everything we do, in all of our relationships with others. Integrity in what we say. Integrity in our work. But the word integrity often conjures up a person of stern and sober visage who walks the straight and narrow. That's not the kind of integrity I'm talking about. I'm talking about integrity with a sense of humor. Integrity with understanding. Integrity with kindness and gentleness, but integrity all the same. Never expediency. Never saying, well, everybody else is doing it. I guess it won't hurt if I do it too. But it does hurt. If it's wrong, and we know it's wrong, it does hurt. The seed for achievement is integrity. Integrity means honesty and the truth. Perhaps it was best put in the famous line by Shakespeare when in Hamlet he has Polonius say, and this above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. If we're true to ourselves, we cannot be false to anyone else. If our word to live by is integrity, we have what we need in a pinch. Our sleep is untroubled, and we're respected wherever we go. During the Korean War, the Chinese communists overran an American position and captured an American general. He was subjected to weeks of the worst kind of treatment, brainwashing and questioning. He never gave in. Finally, he was told that unless he answered their questions, he would be executed the following morning. That night, he wrote a letter to his wife, and at the end of the letter, he said, "Tell Johnny the word is integrity." As it turned out, he was not executed, and he was later repatriated to American forces. But thinking he was going to die, he told his son that the word is integrity. Integrity means to try as best we can to know ourselves, to examine ourselves as Socrates advised, and make a true assessment of ourselves, an inventory of our abilities, our talents, what we want, our goals. Not long ago, I received a letter from Scott D. Palmer, in which he said, "I came across some advice about happiness from my mentor, Dr. Brand Blanchard, that I published in my newsletter some time back. Blanchard is one of the greatest men of our century, even though few people have ever heard of him. He celebrated his 93rd birthday last year with the publication of his latest book, Four Reasonable Men, a biographical book on Marcus Aurelius, Ernest Renan, John Stuart Mill, and Henry Sidgwick. Appropriate for Blanchard, the key virtue that leads to all the others is reasonableness. Brand Blanchard is Sterling Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Yale University, and on the subject of happiness he wrote, 1. It is important to happiness not to think too much about it. The person who continually asks himself if he's happy is apt to miss his end, for happiness, as Aristotle thought, is a byproduct of healthful and successful activity. Bertrand Russell, who wrote The Conquest of Happiness, remarked that scientists are generally happier than artists, since they're commonly lost in objective tasks and not examining their own navels. What is important is to find what one can do best, generally also the line most useful to others, and then to do it with all one's might. Happiness will come unsought. If one seeks it directly, one will be like the discontented old ladies who haunt Miami hotels. 2, the main principle of my ethics is, Brand Blanchard writes, to act as to make the world as much better as possible. I've not lived up to it. No one has. There I disagree with Dr. Blanchard. He has made the world better, and so have many others. But trying to live up to it, he writes, involves constantly looking forward to the consequences of one's actions, choosing those that are likely to be fruitful, and inhibiting action from impulse. Many people think, of course, that acting on impulse is a requirement of happiness, and I agree that impulse must be there, the stronger the better, provided it's under control. But seeking happiness directly by blindly following one's impulses is too likely to end in hippiedom, drugs, and the gutter. And the distinguished Yale professor wrote, "The most important thing I've learned is the necessity of reasonableness. The person who has the least to regret, who does most for his community, whose judgment carries the most weight and is the most trusted, is the person who is steadfastly and on principle reasonable. I don't mean the intellectual who's often an impractical bore. I mean the person who, in matters of belief and matters of action, takes as his principle, adjust your belief or decision to the evidence." And he completes his small essay on happiness by writing, "There's no one meaning of life. No two lives have the same value. The richness of a life depends not on the amount of happiness it achieves, but on finding out who one is, that is, about one's unique combination of powers, and then discovering through experiment and reflection what course of life will fulfill those powers most completely." End of quote. You'll never get better advice. I agree with Scott Palmer that Brand Blanchard, Sterling Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Yale University, in his 93 years, most of them devoted to study and teaching and observing the human species, knows what he's talking about. And to me, reasonableness is another word for integrity. Integrity to truth, to the evidence, no matter where it leads. And I especially liked his saying, "The richness of a life depends not on the amount of happiness it achieves, but on finding out who one is, that is, about one's unique combination of powers, and then discovering through experiment and reflection what course of life will fulfill those powers most completely. What are your powers? There's something, probably several things, that you can do especially well, that you most enjoy doing, and which will, automatically, provide the greatest service to others. Are you ready to discover through experiment and reflection what course of life will fulfill those powers most completely? Now that's being true to yourself. That's integrity. That's reasonableness. As a radio listener wrote to me one day, there's little we cannot accomplish as persons if we manage the conquest of inner space. Being truthful with ourselves means taking the responsibility of making the best use of what we have, and what do we have? We have our underutilized minds, our abilities, our talents, and time. These are our possessions. This is really an immense amount of wealth that belongs to each of us, and it's the investment of our wealth which will determine our rate of return. Our mind, our abilities, our talents, and time. No one can take those away from us. We take them with us wherever we go, and they represent our true wealth. That's what makes the human being autonomous, although most people don't know it. They remind me of the horse or elephant that meekly does what it's told or directed to do. It's completely unaware of its own strength. It doesn't know how easily it can do what it wants to do, and millions of miraculous human creatures live in tiny prisons of their own fashioning, completely unaware of their powers to be free, to do what they would most love to do, and in so doing, reap a harvest beyond their wildest imaginings. They are slaves to their ignorance, and follow each other around and around like so many processionary caterpillars. How have they invested their wealth, their minds, their abilities, their talents, and time? They are not even aware of it. As with the ownership of wealth of any kind, it's left to us to decide what use we'll make of it. We can squander it until it's gone, spend it in a helter-skelter, hit-or-miss fashion without much purpose or meaning, or we can invest it with intelligence and purpose and receive an abundant return, a return which will more than provide for our families all the years of our lives. The choice is ours, and it's here that integrity comes into the picture, for we're the only ones from whom we can steal time, talent, ability, and the use of our minds. It's making the best use of what we have, what we are, in the time that's been granted us. Sound simple? Well, truth is always simple and uncomplicated. As soon as we properly invest our true wealth, we place ourselves above competition. We're no longer competing, we're creating. We're understanding something that the great majority of people have never known. Here is the foundation upon which every great career has been built in every field. So invest in that yellow legal pad and a few ballpoint pens and in your own best quiet time, start making notes. Here are some givens in the success department. Success has nothing at all to do with the size of the brain. The largest brain on record was the brain of an idiot. The smallest, the brain of Anatole France, who won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1921. Some of the world's greatest people in every field are or were short, bald, and fat, some tall and skinny, some were brilliantly educated, some had little or no schooling. The person destined for greatness is the person who decides for himself to follow his or her strongest suit. But truly successful people all have one thing in common. They all follow, consciously or unconsciously, the law of cause and effect. They're true to themselves. Although most people will give lip service to the idea of integrity, they're really not at all sure about it. With a great majority, it's often a matter of expediency. If it's expedient to be honest, fine, they're honest. If it's more expedient to realize a quick profit in some way by not disclosing the whole truth or by shading it a bit, well, that's shaded a bit. They tend to live on the basis of short-term or even instant gratification. They don't see succeeding as a long-range program. They don't know about what I like to call the unfailing boomerang. Every time a person does something dishonest, whether it's small or large, whether it's stealing a pair of pliers from the plant or embezzling $10,000, he's throwing the boomerang. It's the same with small dishonesties, with manipulating the truth. How far the boomerang will travel, no one can tell. Or how great or small a circle it will traverse, only time will tell. But it will eventually, inevitably, come around full circle and deliver its never-failing and painful blow. Honesty, unfailing integrity, is good business. In fact, Mirabeau wrote, "If honesty did not exist, we ought to invent it as the best means of getting rich. Did you know that? Well, believe me, it's absolutely true. And all we have to do, under every circumstance, is ask ourselves, is this true? Is this honest? Is this the best I can do? And if it is, go ahead with the happy realization that we've put in motion the right cause and know that the effect will take care of itself. Our only hope of real success, of winning the hearts and minds of the people we serve, is in helping them in some way and thus improving their standard of living. But if we're content to give less than our best, we're actually working against ourselves. The average working person in our society is paid for about 40 hours a week. This leaves 120 hours a week to do as we please. Never before in the history of humankind have we had so much free time. That's 120 hours a week if we sleep 8 hours every night, three times as much time as we spend on the job. How much is all that time worth? We want our leisure time, of course, time to relax, take it easy, recharge our batteries. But do we need 120 hours for that? Our greatest enemy has never changed, and his name is ignorance. And the greatest ignorance of all is the mistaken belief that we can ever receive more than we truly earn. Sooner or later, there will be an accounting. Every day, for good or bad, we're throwing the boomerang, and just as the punishment always seems to be greater than the offense, the rewards are also out of all proportion to our honest efforts. So let's summarize. What do we mean by integrity? It means giving everything we do our very best. It means being true to ourselves and to every other person with whom we come in contact. This gives meaning and comfort to our leisure time. Our rest has been earned. We know we'll move ahead toward our goals simply because we've become remarkable people. We cannot go unnoticed. The person of integrity is always needed in every undertaking. It means the willingness to keep an open mind, to look for truth, wherever it leads, all the years of our lives, to check things out for ourselves, to weigh what others tell us and make our own judgments. It's knowing that there's always a better way to do everything, and then a better way still to do that. It's looking for that better way in everything we do. It's realizing that the person who does not read is no better off than the person who cannot read, and that a person who does not continue to learn and grow as a person is no better off than one who cannot. It means that we must walk with integrity every day of our lives if we're to truly reap the abundant harvest all the years of our lives. It's realizing that the greatest joy a human being can experience is the joy of accomplishment. Remember to think of your life as that plot of rich soil waiting to be seeded. It can only return to you that which you sow. And what do you have to sow? You have great wealth. You have a mind. You can think. You have many abilities. You have talents that you still may not have explored. And you have time. Time which cannot be saved, stopped, nor held back for a second. Make full use of these riches. It's never too late. Use truth as your guide, integrity as your banner, and your plot of ground will return to you and yours in abundance that will amaze and delight you. And if days come in which you find yourself depressed or confused, remember this comment by Dean Briggs. He wrote, "Do your work, not just your work and no more, but a little more for the lavishing sake, that little more which is worth all the rest. And if you suffer as you must, and if you doubt as you must, do your work. Put your heart into it and the sky will clear. And then out of your very doubt and suffering will be born the supreme joy of life." All kinds of studies have been made with regard to factors which motivate people to live as they do. We've already covered enough ground in this program to establish the fact that people are responsible for their personal lives, barring some act of God or government, catastrophe or war that might intervene to change things, permanently or temporarily. For example, a lot of my friends, many of them very good friends of mine, were killed during World War II when they were in their 20s and 30s. The lives of others have been unalterably modified by injury or serious illness. But for most of us, we have our health, which is the natural inclination of all nature, and we have our lives to live. Sometimes, believe it or not, that's a personal handicap. It often takes the physically handicapped to demonstrate for us the unlimited possibilities that exist as an option for those willing to set goals and stay with them until they're achieved. While the healthy among us often take the path of least resistance. I think it was Bill Veeck when he had the Chicago White Sox who said, "I don't want the natural athlete. I want a guy who'll go after the hard ones." It's the people in this world willing to go after the hard ones who achieve greatness. They're motivated. There's that word again. They're motivated to give the last ounce of themselves in the achievement of their goals. Now let's look at some facts of life. Only about 5% of the people achieve unusual success during their lives. These are the people who earn larger incomes, live in better neighborhoods, in better, larger homes, have better education, more of the good things of life, and make a correspondingly larger contribution to their communities. They tend to speak better English and send their kids to better schools. There are always exceptions to any rule, and there are many exceptions to this 5% group. I know a man who's head of one of the largest, best-known companies in the United States who can hardly put 10 words together in their proper order. If murdering the English language were a misdemeanor, he'd be on death row. Yet he has mansions, yachts, private jets, the works. Why, with no more than perhaps a 6th-grade education and the apparent determination to assiduously avoid any improvement to it, has this man and his family enjoyed such spectacular financial success? Answer: he knows how to serve the people. His organization serves millions of people every day of the week. He's worked hard all of his life to build the great organization he heads, and he's done a fine job of it. So he can buy $3 million yachts and pay cash for them. And when he wants to go someplace in a hurry, there's his Gulfstream 3 warmed up and ready for him when his chauffeur takes him to the airport. But most people in that top 5% fit the earlier description. Many of them are not rich by the standards of our mega-millionaire friend, but they're in the top 5% of American incomes. They're set for life, and they, as a group, tend to enjoy themselves very much. They play a better game of golf or tennis than most of the country's hackers, and they love their lifestyles. Now, a child is born in the United States. The odds, because of the statistics we've been talking about, are 95-5 that he will not be born into this top 5%. Like most children, he'll soon take his environment for granted. Let's assume he's a boy, although it works the same way for a girl. It will save my having to say he or she all the way through this interesting example. He grows up accepting his environment, his world, and his world is his environment as it is. Without giving it a single thought, his environment becomes a natural part of him. Everything about his environment is a conditioning factor. The speech of his parents and relatives and neighbors becomes his speech. What he learns in school will have very little effect on it. That's why you hear grown-up men and women who've gone through the American school system saying such things as "ain't" and "where's it at?" They didn't learn those locutions in school. They were the habitual pattern of speech they heard in their environment. I know an attorney who still says "where's it at?" Anyone's speech habits are an immediate tip-off as to his upbringing. The only reason mine tend to be rather good is because from the time I was a small child, I wanted to be a writer, and words were of great interest to me. Words are the tools of a writer's trade, and a good writer will have a decent inventory of them and tend to keep them well-oiled and shining. I was the only person in our family so affected. The rest had other interests, education not being one of them. If the statistics were reversed, it would be wonderful. If 95% of the people were successful to the degree the 5% are, the odds of a child being raised by the right group would be reversed, but that's not the case. So our typical young man or young woman grows up to mirror his or her environment. He thinks as they think. He takes that life for granted. All the people he loves are in that group. It's his group, too. And if he doesn't come across some unusual motivation along the way, he'll become an indistinguishable part of it. He does that because it's the perfectly natural thing to do. Their goals, or the lack of them, become his goals. A nice house on a nice street, a steady job of some kind, a good, steady income, a good wife and good kids, and so the story goes. He operates on minimums all the years of his life. He never, except while playing his sports or getting ready for a date as a young man, gets out of low gear. It isn't necessary in the United States. This country's so affluent, so vital, and so perennially booming that people don't have to shift into second or third gear in order to meet average requirements. And neither do most of the people throughout the world. Nor should they have to if they don't want to. His wife, while their children are small, is the hardest working human being in our society. She has no 8-hour day or 5-day-a-week